All right, welcome to the History of Israel, Part 4. Tonight we'll discuss the 1910s war in Balfour. As always, the series is sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, Ilan Ishmas, Yonah, Ben, Rav Aryeh Leib. And we thank you for the sponsorship. I think the others just put out on the railing. You can check as they come in. As we came upon 1910, religious lines already drawn in the land of Israel. The old Yishuv, which was still the majority, felt embattled and dismissed and alarmed at the second Aliyah that brought a wave of Jewish socialist unbelievers to the land of Israel. In response to that, they adopted what would become and has become a familiar pattern: insularity, walling themselves off from the rest of society, and contrariness, opposing what the rest of society does, sometimes just because the rest of society does it. So Dafka, they endeavored as a group already, the old Yishuv, to speak only Yiddish and not Hebrew, and that still exists until today, because the Zionists were speaking Hebrew. Right. They framed it in quasi-halachic terms. Hebrew is Lashon HaKodesh, and it should not be used for secular purposes. Of course, in the time of the Torah, they spoke Hebrew for all purposes. But because the Zionists spoke Hebrew, they spoke Yiddish. Because the Zionists were a modern dress, they wore dress as they wore in Europe. Same thing, and nothing has changed today. Even in the last week, the Rav Eliashiv and the Gedolim of what's today the Haredi movement banned the fourth year of study, actually banned the Beis Yaakov seminaries from issuing degrees, bachelor degrees in education, which enable the women to get the better paying jobs, both in the Haredi and in the regular Israeli school system. They banned it because they didn't like necessarily the teachers who were teaching in the degree program, many of whom had masters. Some of the women going on for masters as well. So it was a big upheaval last week in Israel, but still the same thing. It's the same fight now 100 years already. It's simply if something is being done in the society, they're going to challenge it and oppose it. Now, very often, they have shot themselves in the foot. They did the same thing here. As I mentioned last week, but briefly, they made a very big mistake when Rav Shmuel Salant died in 1909. He was the acknowledged Rav of Yerushalayim for decades. He had asked that they appoint Rav Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, as the new Rav of Yerushalayim, and the people refused. They refused because the Rav had always been a Lithuanian. Rav Zonenfeld was the head of the Hungarian Kollel, and they went 10 years, really till 1920, without a leader, without someone who would guide them, without even a communal body that would represent their interests. And therefore, through this very turbulent decade, while there was still a majority of Jews in Israel, nonetheless, they found themselves completely and continually outmaneuvered, marginalized, and ignored, both in terms of politics, in terms of their own needs and interests, and fundraising as well. They acted as if the Zionists would disappear, and the Zionists acted as if they didn't exist. And to some extent, that's true until today as well, but nonetheless, it's to the detriment of both parties. Now, to try to fill the gap and to try to unify, make more cohesive the religious world, in 1912, Agudas Yisrael was founded in Katowice in Poland, which brought together all sectors of frum Jews. And we would say today, it doesn't exist anymore. All sectors of frum Jews, even Mizrahi had representatives, and the Hasidim, the Lithuanians, the Misnagdim, to be the representative body of Torah Jewry. They formed then the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the Council of Torah Sages, to offer guidance in the form of Das Torah, political strategy. At first, they were more influential on the world stage. They did try to take up some of the slack in the 1910s for the absence of a unified decision-making body in the old yeshuv, but nonetheless, they could not fully satisfy or fulfill that role, being outside the land of Israel. In due time, they'd play a role in Israel as well. Now, Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, of course, was the Haredi's Haredi, a very traditional Hungarian Jew, tzaddik, yesod olam, and certainly had a tremendous and deep love of all Jews. But he drew a very firm line against any ideological reckoning with the Zionists. Rav Kook, who was still the chief rabbi of Yafo and the Moshavim, took a different approach, as we know, seeing in the Chalutzim sparks of holiness that needed to be stoked, as they were the ones who were physically redeeming God's land. Rav Kook, of course, we all know, well famous as a lover of Jews. I mentioned this past Shabbos in context, but Rav Kook, it was very difficult to get him to say a negative word about any Jew, and even the Chilonim, and in that sense he was unique in his generation. He was opposed from the left. The Chilonim didn't really care for Rav Kook necessarily, because he was a very traditional, pious, old-fashioned Jew with a beard, face, and a strimal kapota. And the right wing, so to speak, the old Yishuv didn't support him either. So he was constantly being harassed from both sides. One famous story, there were always, when he became the Rav of Yerushalayim finally, and the chief rabbi of Israel, he was always being denounced, but there was one group in particular that always denounced him with wall posters in Yerushalayim that started making its appearance in the 1910s as well. So once a famous wall poster hanger against Rav Kook came to Rav Kook to ask him for tzedakah, and Rav Kook gave him. And an aide protested, "How could you help this man? All he does is make your life miserable." And Rav Kook said, "When a Jew needs help, I only see the Jew. I don't see his politics." They're both great Talmidei Chachamim, Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld, both tzaddikim. They disagreed vehemently on many issues, not only Zionism. Rav Kook wanted, favored an educational system that would teach secular studies as well, in a very modest way. The old Yishuv, especially in Yerushalayim, opposed that strenuously. In fact, there was a ban, a cherem, on the teaching of secular studies in Yerushalayim. They would later differ on the institution of the chief rabbinate, the founding of Hebrew University, and dozens of other issues. But both of them, not always their followers, but both of them showed each other enormous respect, despite the differences, which leads us to an unprecedented act. The famous Tshuva campaign in the fall of 1913. Together, Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld and five or six other Gedolim of Eretz Yisrael, including Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap, embarked on a visit to much of central and northern Israel, as many settlements as they could reach, whether religious or secular, to try to teach Torah and try to be Makarev, the Chalutzim, the pioneers. Very strange. It's hard to portray the ideological differences between Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld, but in our day, if you take a modern Orthodox rabbi and a very Haredi rabbi and expect them to join forces on a tshuva campaign, the fact is, even today, the OU and Agudas Yisrael and Lakewood, they all run separate kiruv programming. You would think they could join, be mekarev together. No, everything is separate. Rav Kook, Rav Zonnenfeld, the others traveled there to Yisrael. They left on Yud Tes Mar Cheshvan in 1913 to give chizuk to religious Jews who were suffering, to try to be mekarev the irreligious, show them in Rav Kook's language the Derech HaMelech. So today it's unimaginable. They left by wagon in the autumn. They went to Chadera and Zichron Yaakov, Haifa, and then secular settlements, Kfar Tavor, Deganya, Menachemya, went to Tveria, Rosh Pina, Tzfat, all across central and northern Israel, traveling for 1 month, and they evoked an amazing response. They kashered kitchens, they raised mechitos in shul, they talked some of the yeshuvim into actually building shuls, they spoke about Trumas and Maestros, they spoke about Shabbos, about Torah education, and they're coming into environments which, to say the least, were inhospitable to their message, talking to people who many of them said had fled Europe in order to escape these Rabbonim. One woman, as the story is told, hearing Rav Kook speak about Kashrus, yelled out to him that next you'll want us to light candles Friday night, she said dismissively. And Rav Kook called her up and said to her, you know, as long as a Jew eats treif, his Jewish eyesight is impaired, and he doesn't really see the beauty of Shabbos. If you would keep kosher, you really would have no objection to lighting Shabbos candles, because you'd see what Shabbos could be as well. V'chein hoyo. And he had a very gentle way of speaking, as did Rav Zonenfeld and the others, and they appealed to them. In one settlement, Rav Kook took off his rabbinic garb and put on the common clothing of a watchman, because they had been on the lookout. The watchman was told, don't let Rabbonim in. We have a similar policy in Mishulachim, certain parts of Tina. Don't let anyone in rabbinic garb enter the settlement. So he entered as in watchman's clothing. And then he came in and he spoke to them, the men about Kedushas Yisrael, and then he said to them, you know, I dress like you, now maybe you'll dress like me for a time, put on talis and tefillin. And so they agreed as well. They went to Merchavia, another secular settlement. And as they approached, a youth working in the field said to them, don't waste your time here. We are comfortable with our lifestyle. And Rav Kook said to him, and this really was the basic theme of the visit. He said, we did not come to influence you. We came to be influenced by you, by your devotion and self-sacrifice to God's land. And with that, they let all the Rabbonim in to listen to what they have to say. While they're in Merchavia, they got word that two Jewish workers had been murdered by Arabs. One of them, named Moshe Barsky, had been dispatched to fetch a midwife to help a woman in the Ganya give birth. So he was killed trying to find the midwife. When word came back to Merchavia that the two the Jews had been killed, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld and Rav Kook eulogized both the martyrs that night in the Yishuv, and people so impressed asked that the Rabbonim arrange for either a Rav or a Shoifet to be sent to Merchavia to help guide them in their religious matters. The woman, Devorah Dayan, gave birth in any event without the midwife, and her son was named Moshe, in memory of Moshe Barsky, who had been killed trying to find the midwife, and that, of course, is Moshe Dayan. Now, they weren't completely successful, obviously. In the fantasy world, everybody started wearing tefillin every day. But they weren't completely successful. They did make remarkable improvements in the religious life, and they planned to do it regularly. But events would intervene. Remember, I said this was the fall of 1913. They wanted to do it again in the near future. In early August 1914, though, Rav Kook left Israel to participate in the Aguda Convention in Poland. And as we'll see in a moment, with the guns of August, World War I broke out. Rav Kook would be unable to return to Israel for almost 5 years. The plans to have these Kiruv missions were shelved, and in fact, they never took place again. And who knows what might have happened in the land of Israel if every 3 months, 6 months, even every year, a delegation of the Gedolei Hador, not second or third tier, but the all-star team, the Gedolei Hador, went around to all the yeshuvim, especially of the irreligious, and were able to speak to them. Something else of interest happened in 1912. I just mentioned it before we move on. Story I told here years ago, the famous Strauss family of merchants in America, Isidore, Nathan, Oscar Strauss, they had purchased Macy's in the 1870s and started Abraham and Strauss around the same time. Famous merchants from the South, they later moved to New York. So in 1911, Nathan and Isidore and their wives took a trip to across Europe and into Israel. And Nathan Strauss, a very wealthy man, was very impressed with what he saw, and he became one of the major philanthropists in the land of Israel. Isidore Strauss and his wife were less impressed. She could not take the mud of the land of Israel, pleaded with her husband to leave. They left early. Nathan and his wife stayed late, stayed for months on end. Israel and his wife left in the spring, the early spring of 1912, left Israel, went to Portsmouth, and there they boarded the Titanic to go back to America, and Israel and his wife sank, were killed on the Titanic. Nathan stayed, became one of the major philanthropists in the land of Israel, building health clinics and soup kitchens, giving money to the poor and infrastructure, buying land, and he's the namesake of Netanya, which was, the land was purchased around this time as well. It wasn't developed until much later. I mentioned Rav Kook had left and was caught outside of Israel by World War I. World War I devastated the world and the land of Israel, and in fact shapes the world until today, probably even more than World War II does. Many of the world's current disputes all emanate from World War I and the aftermath of World War I, certainly in Israel and in Lebanon, which was divided after the war into their different constituent ethnic groups. Iraq, which is in the news, I think, was also divided, formed after World War I with the various confederations there. The Balkans as well, which dispute was the approximate cause of World War I. It was a devastating war. Before the war, Europe had known relative peace. Relative peace almost 40 years, which was unusual for Europe. And as the world was modernizing, the world economies had grown so intertwined that in 1910, a British pacifist named Sir Norman Angell, later won the Nobel Peace Prize, wrote a book called The Great Illusion, which posited that wars are a thing of the past. Wars are outdated, that a universal era of peace was about to dawn. It's a famous incorrect prediction before the book hit paperback. World War I had started and ignited a century of conflict in which over 150 million lives were consumed by war in just the 20th century alone. The most destructive century in human existence since creation. So Europe had relative peace, but already in 1911, 1912, there were wars in the Balkans. The Balkans was always a trouble spot. It's controlled them by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Just think back to the 90s when they, at least momentarily, solved their problems by dividing into independent states. The Balkans have different ethnic groups exercising their diehard nationalistic interests, which cannot be at all compromised. They each want their own land, so Europe was a cauldron. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was in its death throes. The Ottoman Empire was known as the sick man of Europe. It was an Austrian general who said, "What Europe needs is a short little brisk war," I quote, "to straighten itself out, to reshuffle the deck, and you have another half century of peace in order to prevent something major." It was a war, it wasn't short, it wasn't little, and it certainly wasn't brisk. June 28, 1914, a Serbian nationalist, Gavrilo Princip, plots with four others to kill the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, the Archduke Ferdinand Francis, in Sarajevo, in Bosnia, during a parade. So what happened, in fact, is there were five plotters, each stationed at different points in the parade. The first plotter threw a grenade, and the grenade missed. With that, the motorcade decided to take a different route, and Princip saw that it wasn't there. He went, famous story, he went to a deli to buy a sandwich. And waiting for the sandwich took a few minutes. As he picked up the sandwich, he walked out, and the Archduke was riding by in the motorcade on a different route. He immediately put down his gun, I don't know what he did with the sandwich, but he took out his gun, at a distance of 6 feet or so, shot and killed the Archduke and his wife, Sophie. Now, he was 19 years old at the time and was not subject to the death penalty, which only applied to those 20 years old and older. He was sent to a place that became infamous to Jews as well, Theresienstadt. If you visit Theresienstadt, his cell is still there. He was put in a windowless, airless cell. Basically, he lived in the dark. He was allowed out for 1 hour per week. He lived in the dark for 4 years. He had tuberculosis already. He eventually died of tuberculosis 4 years later, weighing 88 pounds. But he triggered a deadly conflict. Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, which was one of its territories, on July 28th, which was Tisha B'Av of that year, a date which, of course, always has significance to Jews as a Yom Muchan L'Poronos, a date set aside for catastrophe. And it really, that war unleashed everything that followed in the rest of the century, including all the disasters that befell the Jewish people. Germany had already an agreement to support Austria-Hungary. The Kaiser Wilhelm, urged his cousin, Tsar Nicholas of Russia, to stay out of the war. It's not really his fight. But Russia had been bound by treaty to Serbia, and it supported Serbia's nationalistic ambitions as a counterweight against Austria-Hungary. Meanwhile, Germany also invaded France and Belgium. Britain intervened to protect Belgium, and the war was on. When Turkey attacked Russia in November, the Allies declared war on the Ottoman Empire, and that's where the Jewish people re-enter the story. But first, the war unleashed tremendous suffering, not just unprecedented carnage in battle, but also tremendous suffering of the civilian population, and especially in the land of Israel. First, the carnage. World War I introduced to the world new weapons, machine guns, tank warfare, airplane warfare, submarine warfare, which made any type of combat much deadlier. Old tactics were still being used, and men were just being carved up. The most gallant rider on a horse does not stand a chance against a machine gun or a tank. And yet that's what you found in different parts of the battles. There were years of stalemate, fighting from trenches, wars that took lives. Again, we think in terms of now the war in Iraq, in which we just lost last week the 3,000th American life. You had days of battle that took more lives. The battles of Verdun and Marne, you're talking tens of thousands of people killed. Enormous casualties. In the 4 years of war, the French lost 1.4 million men. The Germans lost 1.7 million men. The Austro-Hungarians, 1.2 million men. The British, almost a million, not to mention all the others. They estimate, it's hard to know, probably more than 100,000 Jews were killed in battle. Jews fought on both sides of this war. And there are famous stories of Jews encountering each other, especially fought for Germany and for Russia. A Jew being shot on the battlefield and yelling at Shema Yisrael, and the Jew who shot him breaks down in tears. He killed another Jew. There was one German infantry captain named Hugo Guttmann, a Jew, who in 1916 awarded the Iron Cross to a runner, the company runner, for bravery. The runners, the communications were not that sophisticated, so to pass messages, they would literally use people to carry notes from the from trench to trench, or from the trench back to the command headquarters. A runner had a life expectancy of maybe a month, maybe 2 months, because you're just running in a battlefield of live fire. This particular runner survived until poison gas felled him in 1918, but meanwhile, in 1916, this Hugo Guttmann, the captain, awarded the Iron Cross to his runner, who was Adolf Hitler. In 1933, when Hitler took power, Guttmann boasted that he's the one who, because Hitler was very proud of his Iron Cross, Guttmann boasted that he had pinned the Iron Cross on the Chancellor, and Hitler had him arrested as a Jew. But for whatever reason, within a year, let him go, and Guttmann emigrated to America. 1.7 million Russians were killed. They had the most casualties of any army, and they got out after 2 years, in 1916. They were being bled dry. The war was unpopular. The Tsar was always unpopular. 1916, they signed a treaty, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, better known to us as Brisk. In Brisk, they signed a treaty with the Germans. The Tsar was soon overthrown, with the Bolshevik Revolution following the original Kerensky Revolution in November of 1917. Now keep in mind, the United States stay out of this war until 1917. By the end of the war, as that Austro-Hungarian general had predicted, the deck of Europe was completely reshuffled. The Russian Empire had fallen, the Kaiser had fallen, the Ottoman Empire had fallen, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had fallen, the world was remade, and the Jewish world itself was never the same. One other point, the Russian withdrawal in 1916 allowed Germany to fight only in the West, and that had the consequence of extending, of prolonging the war. And through most of 1917 into mid-1918, the war was a stalemate in which thousands of people were being killed every month with no appreciable military gain. And, you know, we're all nostalgic, but the Iraq War is more popular today compared to what World War One was in 1917 and 1918. What happened simply in the middle of 1918, the Germans ran out of resources. They could no longer afford the war. There was a mini revolt in Germany against the Kaiser. The people were tired of the devastation. November 11th, 1918, still Veterans Day in America, the armistice was signed, the Kaiser abdicated, he and his cousin, Tsar Nicholas, were gone, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Emperor was also gone, they lived in the Netherlands for the rest of their lives, and the war that they had unleashed had changed the world. Now, I mentioned that Jews fought on both sides, which on the one hand has the prospect of hedging your bets in case one side wins, but has the more harmful prospect and the reality of Jews being construed as traitors, which is in fact what happened in Europe. Jews were not only fighting for Russia, but for Germany, and not only for France, but for Germany or for the Austro-Hungarians. Jews were on all sides. Now, in fact, the civilian population in Eastern Europe fared better when the Germans made advances in the East, because the Tsar was an out-and-out Jew hater, and the people were much more friendly disposed to the Germans. Not so in Eretz Yisrael, where the Ottomans came down very hard on the Jewish population. It was terrible hardship, dislocation, poverty, disease, even starvation. Rav Kook at this time was in Switzerland. In 1916, he moved to London and became the Rav in Machzike Hadass in London. In Israel, the population was ravaged by starvation. When I say starvation, I mean they would eat oranges for one meal and have the orange peel for the next meal. One third of the population either died or left during the war. It was down to less than 60,000 after the war in 1918, from a high of probably close to 90,000. 18,000 of Yerushalayim's population of 50,000 died during the war, mostly of starvation and disease, cholera, dysentery, other epidemics. Thousands of others, especially Russian nationals, and think back, the Second Aliyah was almost exclusively Russian. Because Turkey had invaded Russia, Russia was their enemy, thousands of Russian nationals were deported, including young leaders such as David Ben-Gurion, Yitzhak Ben-Svi, they were all sent to Alexandria, Egypt. Worse, funds could not be sent into Israel from wealthy Western Jewish countries like Britain or France because Israel was enemy Ottoman territory. Similar thing would happen during World War II where the Americans prohibited sending money to any area under Axis Nazi domination lest that money fall into the hands of the enemy. Money sneaked in anyway, especially from Germany, which was an ally of the Ottomans. And so money could come from there. German Jews raised money, and from American Jewry as well, as long as America was neutral and out of the war. The ambassador to Turkey at the time, the American ambassador, was a Jew named Henry Morgenthau, whose son would become also famous, Henry Morgenthau Jr., as Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, who became helpful towards the last two or three years of the Holocaust. But money did come in. When that money came in, the old yeshuv was denied its rightful share because the Zionists controlled distribution. Remember I said that they had no leader, no nominal head, and they had no organization. They were more or less an ad hoc group. Because of that, they had no representation. And when the money came into Eretz Yisrael, it did not find its way to the people who really needed it most. And most of the old yeshuv was concentrated in Yerushalayim. And that's why you had the greatest number of deaths and terrible illness there that went, and starvation that went unrequited. Some Jews in Israel were forcibly conscripted into the Turkish armies. It's a tremendous upheaval. The world was completely transformed in 4 years. Oddly enough, like the Chinese say, the Chinese symbol for crisis is opportunity. So the crisis presented an opportunity as well. When the war broke out, curiously, the Zionist headquarters was in Berlin. And many voices urged support for Germany against the Allies. Because if Germany was fighting Russia, Russia was always perceived as the leading center of Jew hatred in the world. And the British and the French were more or less lukewarm. The most Zionist of the world leaders then happened to have been the Kaiser. So many Jews wanted to support the Germans. They couldn't oppose the Turks because the Turks lived in Israel. So Jews were more naturally predisposed to the, we call the bad guys in this war, especially since both the Germans and the Turks were wreaking havoc on the hated Russians. The Zionists were officially neutral, though, very cleverly. The office soon moved to Copenhagen, and then events take a different turn because of the activities of a famous individual, Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann was born in 1874 in the Pale of Settlement near Minsk in a little town called Muttel. His father was a very learned Moskal. He, Weizmann, became a Zionist as a child. He was turned on by a teacher. He soon left Russia and studied in Berlin, where he came into contact with Achad Ha'am. He studied chemistry, became a biochemist, and he became a cultural Zionist. If you think back to the second lecture about cultural political Zionism, he favored actually rebuilding the spirit of the Jewish people in the land of Israel before undertaking any political maneuvers. He, Weizmann, was one of the leading rebels against Herzl's Uganda plan, and in fact one of those who led a walkout from the Zionist Congress in which the plan was approved. But after Herzl died and the movement was floundering somewhat, he became the leader of a faction that was known as Synthetic Zionism. Synthetic not because it's ersatz or phony, but just as a derivative of synthesis. What Weizmann then proposed, and this became the dogma of the Zionist movement for the next 30 years, was a synthesis of political Zionism and cultural Zionism. You'll do both. You'll try to do both. You may not be able to do both with equal efficiency, but nonetheless, don't neglect one at the expense of the other. After Herzl's death, Weizmann moved to London. He became a British citizen a few years after that. He became a leader, not the leader, but a leader of Zionist activities in London. By coincidence, in 1906, he became a professor of biochemistry at the University of Manchester, and there he met the Prime Minister. Actually met him in London at a dinner party. The Prime Minister then was a man named Arthur Balfour. Now, Weizmann introduced Balfour to the Zionist idea, and Balfour was intrigued by it as a believing Christian. He asked Weizmann during their first conversation, why didn't you take Uganda, which after all was a British protectorate, and therefore the British government was involved? And Weizmann said to Balfour, would you abandon London for Paris? And Balfour said, of course not, London is my capital. To which Weizmann replied, Yerushalayim was our capital when London was still a marsh, a swamp. And Balfour was very impressed, and he became a philo-Zionist, motivated more by the notion of Christian Zionism, but there's some interest that Christians have in having Jews come back to Israel, and this would bear fruit more than a decade later. When the war started, Weizmann wasn't the Zionist leader in London. Nachum Sokolov was, streets named after him in Israel as well. And together, though, they nurtured friendly contacts with the government, all of whom were primed to look at the Zionist movement with sympathy. Among them, David Lloyd George became the prime minister in 1916, and Balfour himself, who was voted out of office and then retook a seat in the cabinet as foreign secretary in 1916 as well, and a Jew named Herbert Samuel, who was the home secretary among other posts that he held. Herbert Samuel will become the first British High Commissioner when the Mandate takes over, and he himself was a Jew with Zionist leanings. Another consequence, another opportunity the war presented. Jews fought on every side of the conflict, as I noted, but the greatest symbolic impact came in the formation of the first Jewish army unit since the Churban, known as the Zion Mule Corps. Don't get any idea that the Zion Mule Corps played a decisive role in the war, but nonetheless had a tremendous symbolic impact. It was the brainchild of Vladimir Zev Jabotinsky and Yosef Trumpeldor. More on Trumpeldor next week, but Jabotinsky was one of the famous controversial figures in the history of Zionism, born in 1860, originally secular, completely secular. He was an acclaimed Russian writer who published widely, not only about Jewish topics. He would often write in Russian magazines, later in Russian Jewish magazines, under a pen name, Altalena. Keep that name in mind as well. He was fluent in six languages, and he, in the 1890s, became enamored with Zionism and the Zionist movement. The thing with Jabotinsky is that he was a maverick, always was. He was a thorn in the side of the establishment. Even in the early years, I don't think he was in the first Congress, but by the second Congress he was there. He was a very independent thinker. He became the lightning rod of the Zionist movement, and he was never appreciated for it. He was always a step ahead and always criticized for it. So, for example, he was, in his youth, something of a socialist, although never a Marxist, but he abandoned it completely by his maturity, his adult life, when he became heavily involved in the 1910s and 20s, and became a free market capitalist. So the socialists hated him for it. He was the first to write, actually the second to write, that the Arabs would never accept a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. This at a time when the Zionist dogma was that the Arabs favored the Jewish presence in Israel because they were bettering the life of everyone there. He wrote that the war gave the Jews a chance to wrest the land of Israel from the Turks. And he wrote it openly, despite the fact that the Ottomans wouldn't want to hear it. So he, like Weizmann, cast his lot with the British. He established the Zion Mule Corps, which fought in the ill-fated 1915 Gallipoli campaign, in which Churchill, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty, hoped to attack Germany from the south, the southern flank, by invading through Turkey. At Gallipoli, the British forces were massacred, and the Zion Mule Corps were also roundly destroyed. Churchill himself was condemned and fell out of favor, wouldn't really regain favor for two decades. Unbowed, Jabotinsky formed another army with a nicer name, the Jewish Legion, to fight against the Turks in Israel, and in fact that was more successful. 6,500 Jews in Israel joined the Jewish Legion, and they fought with the British Army, joined them in Egypt. General Lord Edmund Allenby, in the 1917 campaign which came through Egypt, wrested Sinai, and then into the land of Israel. Now both these military units, the Zion Mule Corps and the Jewish Legion, were bitterly opposed by the Zionist establishment, which favored diplomacy, pacifism, the sort of niceness that the Jewish people are always associated with, and that would also become a pattern that exists until today as well. Keep in mind something else. At the same time that the Jewish Legion and the British Army were fighting the Turks, there was the first sparks, so to speak, of Arab nationalism, with T.E. Lawrence fighting in the Arabian Peninsula with the Hashemites to drive out the Turks as well successfully. Now, what he did, Lawrence of Arabia, better known to us as Peter O'Toole, what he did also played a role, somewhat exaggerated, but played a role in shaping the Arab consciousness of a national existence which they did not have before. To some extent, they don't have it today even. They're very tribalistic in that. But Lawrence of Arabia was able to successfully mobilize Arab forces and motivate them to look at the world in a different way. One other point about the Jewish involvement in the war, and that's the famous group of Jewish spies, British spies, known as Neeli, Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, in the 60s, that was one of Israel's passenger ships, tourist ships, the Neeli, actually sailed on it once. The Neeli, Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, was led by the Aronson family of Zichron Yaakov. In Zichron Yaakov next, there's a very nice museum that describes their adventures. They spied on the Turks for the British, giving the British word of Turk troop movements and headquarters, capabilities, etc. There's no doubt that they facilitated the British conquest of the land of Israel. They were partially successful, but whatever success they had was short-lived. Most of them were killed. Very famously, Sora Aronson, who was the sister of the founder, Aharon Aronson, she was arrested by the Turks, as most of them eventually were, tortured, and she eventually killed herself, shot herself to avoid further torture. Sara Aronson, very famous Zionist heroine until today. The founder of the group, Aaron Aronson, was an agriculturalist who'd worked with the U.S. Department of Agriculture in trying to implement methods of growing crops in the land of Israel. Because of his connections, he became one of the distributors of American cash in the land of Israel during the war. He actually lived until 1919. He died in a plane crash. But also, Neeli was the stuff of Jewish legend, the first Jewish spy group. With all of which brings us to the Balfour Declaration of 1917. So the three developments that preceded it, of which we have to be aware, really a confluence of events. Firstly, Weizmann, the chemist, had been very helpful to the British. Lloyd George sung his praises because the Germans had a compound known as acetone, which was used as a solvent that refined the explosive capabilities of artillery shells. The Germans had it, the British did not. Weizmann set about to manufacture acetone, and he did it finding properties that were useful in walnuts. So during the war, you had British children running up and down the countryside trying to get walnuts to give to Dr. Weizmann. This endeared him to the British government officials. Lloyd George himself said to Weizmann, whatever we can do for you, we'll do. And Weizmann said, famously, I want nothing for myself. I only want something for my people. Now, speaking of Weizmann's people, in 1916, British and French diplomats named Sykes and Picot negotiated amongst themselves in secret, anticipating the conquest of the Ottoman Empire. They wanted to divide the Middle East into different spheres of influence, and that's the first map you have on the handout. It says 1915, but they actually signed the agreement in 1916. Now, no secret agreement remained secret for long, and as you could see from the map, it was fairly exhaustive. The British sphere of influence is most of Transjordan into Israel. The French sphere of influence is in what is today Iraq, including if you look down in the lower right portion, that area of the Persian Gulf, which was actually given to Britain as a protectorate, is where the Iraqi city of Basra is located. So if you just want to know why are the British forces today concentrated in Basra, and the Americans are in Baghdad and elsewhere in the country, it's because Basra and that area, southern Iraq, had been a British protectorate since World War I. The French were given part of the area. Russia and Italy were given part of the area as well. The British and French diplomats could not fathom that the Russian Empire would fall. These were the territories that were delineated so that when they would conquer the Ottoman Empire, it would not be chaotic. Rather, each country would take its rightful share. Something else happened around this time as well that was also relatively secret, and that's not widely known. What was called the Hussein McMahon correspondence. Henry McMahon was the British High Commissioner in Egypt. Hussein ibn Ali was the Sharif of Mecca. He headed the Arabian Peninsula. Through a series of letters, McMahon representing the British government, McMahon committed to give Arabia to the Arabs except for the areas west of Damascus. Now, in the Arab mind, that included the areas south of Damascus, including the land of Israel. The British had no such intention, apparently, but that became, in the Arab mind, their documentary evidence of their rightful possession of the land of Israel, in contradistinction to the Balfour Declaration. Now, frankly, nobody refers to the Hussein McMahon correspondence anymore. It was 1915, 1916, the same time as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Jews refer to the Balfour Declaration much more. Nonetheless, I'm not entirely sure whether the world really cares about Balfour anymore today either. Something else happened also then. As noted, Allenby entered the land of Israel in October. Allenby entered Israel in October of 1917, and the Turks surrendered soon after. Famous picture of Allenby entering Shaar Yafo. I'm sure you've all seen it. He, in respect to the place, dismounted from his horse and reviewed his troops right inside Shaar Yafo. Everything looks the same. There's a newer building to the left of the entrance now, but the basic framework looks the same. You recall that Shaar Yafo had been bought and taken down to allow the Kaiser, who refused to dismount, to enter Yerushalayim. Allenby dismounted, made a tremendous impression on the Old Yishuv and the Zionists who were there, respect for the place. Hence, he deserves to have Rehov Allenby named after him in Tel Aviv and other places. And he was known to be also a philo Zionist. He entered Yerushalayim December 1917, and then everything changed. A famous picture, by the way, of Allenby with Rav Zonenfeld and some other Rabbanim, because when he entered Yerushalayim, he went to meet the Rabbanim of the city. Very polite. Now, Sokolov and Weizmann requested of the British a formal statement of support for Zionism, for the aims of Zionism. They had a sympathetic audience. Balfour, of course, was the foreign minister, foreign secretary. Lloyd George, who was the prime minister. The language itself was argued over, as there were different goals. And we'll note it in the language itself. It took the form, you have it copied at the bottom of the page, a letter that came from the Foreign Office, November 2nd, 1917, addressed to Lord Rothschild, because he had the money. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, it's from Arthur Balfour himself, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. And this is really the text of the declaration. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It sounds very good. Weizmann, among others, protested at first because what does a national home mean? If the British, who will soon be the conquerors, the dominant force in the land of Israel, want to establish a state, a Jewish state, they should say so. A national home doesn't sound like a state. But they could have lived with that had it stopped there. Because of pressure from British Jews, including a Jew, an assimilated Jew in the cabinet named Edwin Montague, who feared the accusation of dual loyalty, this clause, the following clause was added, which on one hand, you can make an argument, undermined the intent of the Balfour Declaration, and on the other hand, has certainly muddied the waters in the ensuing 90 years. So His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment of a Jewish national home. They'll use their best endeavors to facilitate it, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That last clause was the Montague Clause. The intermediate clause, nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, was the British recognition that the Arabs might not be happy about this, and therefore it gave them wiggle room. Weizmann was very upset at this language, because what did it mean? If in fact a Jewish national home, almost by definition, would prejudice the civil and religious rights of non-Jews in the land of Israel. So it is a stira me'elov. There's an inherent contradiction in it. Nonetheless, in subsequent decades, Jews would emphasize the first part, Arabs the second part, and assimilated Jews the third part. That it may be called a national home, but it doesn't mean me. I'm a good Englishman, I'm a good Frenchman, I'm a good American. Now, Montague's attitude, prevalent then, not as much today anymore, was that Jews can have a place to live, like Arabs, for Judaism is a religion, not a nationality. Keep in mind, many Jews oppose this. We should keep in mind as well the role that America played. The United States government was supportive of the Balfour Declaration, although never explicitly, because they didn't have a dog in that hunt. You'll notice the Sykes-Picot agreement didn't mention America at all. Wilson was close with Louis Brandeis, who was the Supreme Court Justice, the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice, was appointed by Wilson. Brandeis was the president of the Zionist Organization of America, so every year they give out the Louis Brandeis Award. Brandeis became a Zionist in 1911, and he became very active. And he even spoke to Wilson about it. Wilson was very supportive, also of a Christian Zionist mentality. Less so, what else is new? The Secretary of State Lansing and Wilson's aide-de-camp Colonel House, they were not supportive. When the Balfour Declaration was first proposed in the summertime, Wilson accepted it. Lansing said it's unacceptable, it'll ruin our relations with the Arab world, and it was rejected. When it actually came to fruition, Wilson issued a statement of support to Weizmann. In fact, Weizmann came to Washington to meet Wilson in the summer of 1917. Now, why did the British do it? There's no doubt it's multidimensional. There was groundwork laid by the Zionist leaders over the years, the personal relationship. There was the Christian Zionist romantic notion of restoring the Jews to the land of Israel that had coexisted along with a very genteel type of British Jew hatred that always exists. There was a desire to enlist world Jewry's support of British war aims. And you'll keep in mind that the Hussein McMahon correspondence was designed to enlist Arab support for British war aims. The British also wanted to, remember, the war was in a stalemate, basically. The British wanted to preempt the Kaiser from issuing a similar declaration. And their persistent reports that had the British not done it, the Kaiser would have done it, which would have even further strengthened whatever Jewish support that he had. And of course, the British wanted to ensure Jewish support of British hegemony in the land of Israel after the war, especially against the French. Jews, probably alone in the world, celebrate that day still, November 2nd, 1917, as Balfour Day. Many compared it to the declaration of Cyrus Koresh, the emperor of Persia, permitted Jews to return and build the second base of Mikdash. It also obviated what was a philosophical problem that, you know, vexes Naturi Kart until today, the Gimel Shvuos. One of the Gimel Shvuos, the three oaths, so to speak, that the Jewish people were jured to take. The Gemara records it in Ksuvos Daf Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, Shelo Ya'alu Bachoma. The Jews are not allowed to conquer Eretz Yisrael by force, against the will of the nations of the world. When the Balfour Declaration came out, the Chafetz Chaim already saw that something different was happening, and the Arsameach himself, from Simcha of Dvinsk, wrote, with the Balfour Declaration, we cannot be in violation of any of the Shavuos anymore, because you see, we have the world's permission to go and reestablish a Jewish state in the land of Israel. Clearly, the Jews saw the Balfour Declaration as a prelude to a state. It could be at the time Lloyd George and Balfour did as well, although they specifically did not use the word state, they used the word national home. With the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, you recall from high school Wilson's 14 points, the division of the world that took place a few years after that, the British mandate over the land of Israel was confirmed, and in fact, the Zionist movement was represented at the Paris Peace Conference, both by its leaders, American Zionists as well, were part of the American delegation led by another future Supreme Court Justice, Felix Frankfurter. They made the request. They made a whole, the whole document that still exists of their request for the Paris Peace Conference to establish a Jewish state in the land of Israel. And they submitted a map of what that state would look like. That map is on the flip side. And you see it's a nice looking state going as far north as Sidon in Lebanon, as far south as El Arish in Gaza. Significantly, it includes land on both sides of the Jordan. That would become Jabotinsky's mantra in the 20s. Still a famous Beitar song. There you go. Shtei Gadot LaYarden. The Jordan River has two banks, not one. It goes as almost as far as Amman, stopping just short of the Hejaz Railway, which went from Damascus all the way to the Arabian Peninsula. Well, what happened with this map? It's a nice map. The fact is the Paris Peace Conference did not adopt either the map or the proposals of the Zionist movement. Nonetheless, in one of the strangest documents you'll ever find, a letter was written to Felix Frankfurter as the head of the American Zionist delegation by the Emir Faisal, who at the time was the king of Syria, but better known to us as the king of Iraq for 40 years, who was a dominant ruler in the region. It's a wonderful letter. Halavai, it would have been a majority opinion. He wrote, you have it on the left. He was also in Paris, March 3, 1919. Dear Mr. Frankfurter, I want to take this opportunity of my first contact with American Zionists to tell you what I've often been able to say to Dr. Weizmann in Arabia and Europe. We feel that the Arabs and Jews are cousins in race, having suffered similar oppressions at the hands of powers stronger than themselves, and by a happy coincidence have been able to take the first step towards the attainment of their national ideals together. We Arabs, especially the educated among us, look with deepest sympathy on the Zionist movement. And then he goes on, and he writes towards the next paragraph, the Jewish movement is national and not imperialist. Our movement is national and not imperialist, and there's room in Syria for us both. Indeed, I think that neither can be a real success without the other. People less informed, less responsible than our leaders and yours, ignoring the need for cooperation of the Arabs and Zionists, and trying to exploit the local difficulties that must necessarily arise in Palestine in the early stages of our movements. Some of them, I'm afraid, have misrepresented your aims to the Arab peasantry and our aims to the Jewish peasantry, with the result that interested parties have been able to make capital out of what they call our differences. Nonetheless, he says, anything can be solved by mutual goodwill. I look forward, and my people with me look forward, to a future in which we will help you and you will help us, so that the countries in which we are mutually interested may once again take their place in the community of civilized peoples of the world. Believe me, yours sincerely, Faisal. Halavai. Needless to say, he quickly turned out to be a minority. The Zionist mantra had always been a people without a land for a land without a people. It soon turned out that the land had a people. Who they were, where they came from, how many they were, what they wanted, whether they had any real sympathy for Jewish interests, that will be the subject of different and irreconcilable narratives over the next 8 decades. And how the interests of the Jews could be satisfied without prejudicing the rights of the existing population, in the language of the Balfour Declaration. So that has preoccupied the world for the last 90 years, since the Balfour Declaration, 90 years and counting, without any resolution or enduring success. In the meantime, as the Arabs began to protest, the British, as 1920 came upon us, started to look to walk away from the Balfour Declaration. With that, the Arabs saw an opportunity, and you have the first sustained violence against Jews in the land of Israel, which would color first the decade of the 20s and really shape the rest of the conflict. Thank you very much.